Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Suzanne Higgins. Before COVID-19 turned our world inside out, our Inside Appalachia team began working on a story that really pulls at the heartstrings. It took place nearly 50 years ago, but emotions are still raw over what happened. Residents in a predominantly African-American neighborhood in Charleston, West Virginia, were pushed out to make room for urban development and an interstate overpass.
I never could figure out why they wanted to disperse the blacks like that. I couldn't understand that because I didn't see us bothering anybody.
I don't know how I would have done it any other way, and I don't feel good about their bad feelings. And I know a lot of these folks, and a lot of them are still around, and they're upset.
And we'll hear from residents of Charleston today who are helping their neighbors find healing and recovery in different ways. One man in his 80s has a vision for how community gardens can help.
What I've done with my family, can I do this with the neighbor, with the homeless and street people? Can I do that with them? This is inclusive. Anybody who wants to come in and join with me, they can.
You'll hear these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia.
Hi, I'm Roxy Todd, producer of Inside Appalachia. The recent killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minnesota has reignited the Black Lives Matter movement, sparking protests across the country, including in several cities in West Virginia. It's launched candid conversations about long-held institutionalized and systemic racism and brought forth stories of individuals that are vital to understanding injustice in our country. And so we thought it would be a good time to revisit an episode we originally produced earlier this year. We focus on one chapter in the history of the Black community of Charleston, West Virginia. In the second half of the broadcast, we'll hear from residents of Charleston today who live in the West Side neighborhood. We'll hear why these residents feel events that occurred more than 40 years ago are still having ripple effects today. Suzanne Higgins hosted this episode. I'll let her pick it up from here.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Suzanne Higgins, guest hosting this week. The neighborhoods and communities we live in today are shaped by the history that came before us. How were your neighborhoods built and zoned? How have they evolved? And what about funding that has been spent to develop your community in the past decade or century? In a way, that history laid much of the foundation for how we interact with each other now, where we attend school, and even how we earn a living. Your life can have dramatically different challenges or benefits depending on where you live. And if you belong to a minority group, if you're Black or Hispanic, for example, statistics show you face further disadvantages. Our cities are technically integrated, but undertones of racial discrimination still affect how our communities are developed and the funding that is distributed among different neighborhoods. And all of this affects health and well-being. People who grow up in neighborhoods with high concentrations of low-income residents, or where a majority of people are Black or Hispanic, are less likely to graduate from college or earn a living wage. They have worse health outcomes and lower life expectancy.
Ain't gonna let nobody
In the 1950s and 60s, African Americans became mobilized in an unprecedented fight for equality. The civil rights movement was a national struggle, played out in every community for social justice, a battle against racism and violence. At the same time, interstates were being built across the country, and while these projects brought economic opportunities, in many cases their construction forced residents, often poor and non-white, out of their homes to make way for the roads. They often had little assistance in finding a new place to live. But the amended Federal Aid Highway Act of 1968 was designed to change that. It said the government didn't have the authority to remove people for interstate projects if it didn't have an adequate plan to relocate them. One of the first tests of the new law played out in Charleston, West Virginia. Here, residents of a predominantly black neighborhood known as the Triangle District were forced out, and their community, once steeped in the richness of black music and culture, was demolished. In its place, a water treatment plant was built first, and then new stretches of Interstates 64, 77, and 79. The situation was so contentious, it led to angry protests beginning in the mid-1960s. Roxy Todd and Eric Douglas have been spending time with residents who recall this tumultuous period. They say they were deliberately ignored and shut out of the process. So we're going to spend the first half of today's show listening to their side of the story.
In a neighborhood that wraps around the Elk River in downtown Charleston, West Virginia, an enormous interstate bridge thunders over a community center, a daycare, and a small Baptist church.
Semi-trucks and cars pound overhead. If you've passed through Charleston, chances are you've driven across this bridge and over this neighborhood. It's known as the Triangle District because of its three borders. The Elk River on one side, Slack and Capitol Streets on another, and Washington Street on the third.
It's Sunday morning. 78-year-old Myrna Badger Geiger is dressed in a navy blue suit. She's been attending the Metropolitan Baptist Church since she was a little girl. The original church building stood about a block away, next door to the house where she grew up. But it's more than the location of the church building that's changed.
As I look out the front door, you know, I can visualize our old house across the street. I can see the neighborhood that's not there anymore. So, and it gets kind of hard. I miss those ties quite a bit.
We're sitting down together inside Pastor Latari Thompson's study. Mrs. Geiger pulls out a photo album from 1970.
Brother, and this is my grandmother. So these are pictures that were taken from the old church.
These photos and the memories are all that she has left.
That's my mother there.
Myrna Geiger continues to talk about the people she misses. While in the sanctuary, the service begins. Gospel music plays in the background while she reminisces.
If you're not familiar with the area and what it looked like prior to urban renewal coming through and interstate, then it's hard to visualize. Now,
Mrs. Geiger grew up here in the Triangle District. In the 1960s, a water company replaced part of the neighborhood. And then the West Virginia Department of Highways built an interstate exchange through Myrna Street. The controversy would pit black families, civil rights groups, neighborhood alliance groups, and war on poverty groups against the Charleston Chamber of Commerce, the State Road Commission, and former Governor Arch Moore over what these supporters said was an urban renewal project for an area the city had neglected for years.
Myrna's community was essentially wiped out. According to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, widely known as HUD, which financed the demolition project, it tore down a staggering 383 homes and 107 businesses. Only 12 buildings were spared. HUD has no official count of how many people it displaced.
Trying to find a place to go and having the money to move was a big problem for most of the black families that lived in the Triangle when urban renewal came through. Some people got help and some people didn't get help. That was very hard for a lot of people.
What I hear in her voice is weariness, and it hasn't faded with time. In some ways, Myrna and some of the other residents feel like the city of Charleston has never truly reckoned with this story. That their experiences were ignored or pushed aside to make room for a different type of city.
Since most of the people who were pushed out of the Triangle District rented, they had to find landlords who would rent to them in other areas. And that was tough because there was a housing shortage. There was also plenty of discrimination if landlords didn't want to rent to a family who was black.
Yeah, and it was done discreetly. I mean, people know how to get around that sort of thing. So they played the game, and people, you know, you have to leave. You have to find some place to go. So you can't wait for somebody to make a decision.
In 1967, Myrna's husband, Burley Geiger, led a march to protest unfair housing conditions. They were marching for the many low-income residents across the city who lived in rental apartments or homes. He and other housing advocates said there were often roaches in these rentals. They were poorly maintained, and white landlords often discriminated against black tenants.
They had several meetings and several marches downtown and in the Triangle, you know, to try to bring that to the forefront. But if the only reason why they are turned down is because the color of their skin, you know, that's not fair.
And there were marches out here, and people were upset, and there are still people that are upset.
Danny Jones finished a 16-year tenure as Charleston's mayor in 2019. He grew up in the city and empathizes with the loss of a community with such a rich, vibrant history. Jones is white, but he often visited the Triangle District. He even worked in a popular neighborhood restaurant called the Sterling.
The Triangle was a neat place. It had a lot of character. I was so happy I got to know some of those folks and waited on a lot of them at the Sterling. And the people that were engaged in the vice, they were good tippers.
What Danny Jones is referring to when he says vice are the three notorious activities that went down in homes throughout the Triangle, starting years before interstate construction was ever considered. There was prostitution, gambling, and lots of illegal drinking.
Back then, there wasn't a law in the books that allowed bars to sell liquor by the drink. There was an understanding, though, that clubs would operate like this illegally in neighborhoods like the Triangle. And so lots of restaurants, like the one Jones worked at, were open late.
And there were no hours on them. I'd get off work 6 o'clock in the morning, and there'd still be people going in and out of those clubs.
Larry Moore grew up in the Triangle. Though he was just a kid in the 1950s, he later learned that his neighborhood featured a lively nightlife with brothels, illegal bars, and gambling.
Oh, Court Street was notorious. It was known worldwide. You could find everything and anything on Court Street.
But it wasn't just the red light district. The Triangle was also famous because of the musicians who came here. Mike Jones's grandmother ran one of the neighborhood brothels and an illegal liquor bar out of her home.
Oh, James Brown came by my grandmother's house.
Yes, he is talking about the James Brown. Musicians who were on tour playing shows in D.C. or Baltimore would often pass through Charleston, sometimes to play a show or just to have a drink of moonshine.
They would leave their gigs there and stop in Charleston, West Virginia. And they always stopped at my grandmother's kitchen.
And Mike Jones often snuck downstairs to watch and listen to James Brown.
This guy was supposed to be in a bed. And they were sitting there getting drunk and laughing. And he would start singing and dancing because they had the jukebox going on. And I remember one time, I think, I don't can't remember if it was his song or nothing. He was dancing and doing his little thing. And all of a sudden he did a split. And I was like, wide-eyed. You know, Cab Calloway was in my grandmother's kitchen, you know, because he and my grandfather were good friends. And so they'd get there drinking that corn liquor, and next thing you know, Cab Calloway was up there singing, my grandfather was singing, and it was just like a big party.
Hey, folks, here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a low-down, hoochie-coochie.
Jazz musician Bob Thompson moved to Charleston in the late 1960s. Back in those days, he recalls that musicians often stayed up all night playing bebop or improv jazz at many of the clubs throughout the Triangle.
You know, Charleston used to be a stop on what they used to call the Chitlin' Circuit, you know, where musicians used to come through here all the time. And there were musicians, there was a great piano player who was from Philadelphia who played around D.C. His name was Fats Wright, and he was an Art Tatum type piano player, and he would just come to Charleston and stay, you know, for a month or so, just playing and hanging out, you know. And so there was that kind of history, you know.
And Thompson says the music and the lively night scene were very integrated.
And the thing about it is that the musicians, you know, both black and white, all played together. You know, there was, I know in other cities they had separate musicians' unions, but not in Charleston. The musicians were always together, you know. And I thought that was, I took it for granted until I saw what was happening in other places.
Danny Jones says the cops even came to the neighborhood as customers themselves.
The police start wondering, what laws do I enforce and what laws do I not enforce? And the vice was accepted because the police were in on it.
But according to Mike Jones, the one whose grandmother ran a brothel and a legal bar, every election year, politicians would make a big fuss about cracking down on crime in the Triangle.
They would take her in and book her, you know, like they're hard on crime. And the next morning she would come out, start doing her thing again.
So what he remembers is this would happen only during election years. The rest of the time, the police left his grandmother alone.
So that's where I first learned politics and the game of it. Yeah.
Things started to change by the 1960s. Charleston city officials began working to redevelop the Triangle, partly as a way to shut down these red light businesses for good.
A newly formed group called the Charleston Urban Renewal Authority, known as CURA, wanted to see new shops and businesses locate to this area of downtown. A report from the redevelopment project says the plan was intended to tear down a blighted neighborhood and remove houses that were dilapidated. They also supported the plan to route the interstate through the Triangle District. Obviously, most of the residents of the Triangle neighborhood did not.
Residents say they had no input in the process once the government began buying out their landlords and condemning homes to make way for the construction. Again, here's former Mayor Danny Jones.
It was owned by the trust departments at the banks. It was owned by white folks.
Right, rental properties.
So if you came and gave them money to walk, they'd walk.
One Charleston resident who tried to stop the demolition of the neighborhood was Emerson Reed. Reed was the son of a preacher and says he had been motivated by other activists like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. Here at a public meeting in the late 60s, Reed refers to the original plan for the interstate that would have routed it through Kanawha City, a plan ultimately rejected by city and state officials.
Well, it's hard to speak for everybody in Triangle, but like a general thing is the road. An interstate should not be coming through a city. It should be going around the city. The road isn't wanted. The governor can, by, you know, an executive order, have the road rerouted, which has been done earlier when the road was tentatively going through Kanawha City, but it was rerouted. It's going to be rerouted to save hills around the capital. It's going to be rerouted in Logan County, you know. And if he can look out for the poor little white farmers, he can look out for the poor little angry black people in the Triangle District, you know.
In Reed's view, both the water company project and the interstate project were routed through the Triangle neighborhood as a convenient way to displace black residents and push them out of the city.
He and the group of residents who protested the demolition appealed to the Federal Bureau of Public Roads, today's Federal Highway Administration, which temporarily put a halt to the construction.
But on the other side of the debate, city officials and Governor Arch Moore defended the plan to demolish homes in the Triangle District to make way for the interstates.
As the plan was being debated and reassessed by various government entities in the late 60s and early 70s, residents of the Triangle neighborhood took to the streets to protest. They marched, rallied, and even stood in the way of bulldozers to try to prevent them from demolishing homes.
To protest the lack of housing for the displaced residents, Emerson Reed organized a demonstration along the Elk River in an encampment they called Tent City. He says he camped out there for 6 months with about 75 others.
We just got together and we said we had to do something because our voices weren't being heard at that time. We just put up tents and lived in those. I literally lived in there, you know. A lot of the white hippie children during the time came down and they protested. They were there, you know, in the community.
But Reed says one of the most incredible parts of the demonstration was that older people joined the younger protesters.
They couldn't sleep out on the ground at night, but they would actually literally just sit with us and support us during the day. You know, if we needed something, they'd contact a newspaper, or go to the courthouse, you know, and get documents and stuff for us. It was a lot of participation and a lot of activity, a lot of hubbub. There was a ball field, and that's where Tent City was, where the water company plant parking lot is now.
Another community organizer in the Triangle was Carol Tillman. Like Emerson Reed, her father was also a preacher.
And the people that got involved, some of those people were residents of the Triangle, but everybody was not a resident of the Triangle, but they understood what was happening and they wanted to have wanted some involvement into making it turn out right.
In 1968, changes to the Federal Aid Highway Act said that states had to ensure, among other things, that residents displaced by the interstate highway system would have help from the government to relocate. The government didn't necessarily have to give them a new place to live, but there had to be a plan in place. By 1970, the debate over the displacement of the Triangle had been going on for several years. Similar situations and protests over interstate projects were occurring across the country. That same year, a New York Times article featured Charleston's Triangle District and the citizens' fight to save their homes and community, a fight that was taken all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
But by 1971, it was all over. The Supreme Court decided not to hear the case regarding the Triangle neighborhood. They ruled that the amended Federal Highway Act of 1968 did not apply to this case, in part because the interstate project was already underway by the time the 1968 amendments were made.
What we do know is that some people didn't even know the plan to take out the neighborhood had been approved until the demolition began. Remember, this is before the internet or Facebook, and the city caught some people completely unaware, recalls Carol Tillman.
Some people were still asleep in their homes when the bulldozers came in.
Carol Tillman reiterates that residents had very little say in the planning process.
These people didn't know what was going on until it started happening, because they didn't have any power. And when we would talk about things like going to city council meeting and going to planning commission meetings, because that's where these plans were drawn up to completely do away with the Triangle. And the residents were supposed to be part of the planning process, but they didn't know it. And the people who were in authority knew it, but because nobody held them responsible to follow the rules, they kind of looked the other way on some of the things that they had to do.
Triangle native Carl Foster was worried about what would happen to his neighbors and family. In the 1970s, he took a job as a relocation officer with the Charleston Urban Renewal Authority. His job was to try to find new homes for residents who were suddenly displaced.
I mean, we didn't have the resource or the houses to accommodate those many people. And so, like I say, the resistance was, y'all moving us, we ain't gonna never get back here, we ain't gonna never come back, and y'all just destroying lives, people's lives by moving them, and they didn't want that.
By 1974, construction on the interstate overpass began.
Reverend Ronald English moved to Charleston in the midst of the Triangle controversy. Before moving to Charleston, he traveled throughout the Deep South working as a preacher and a civil rights leader. He says the type of racism he saw here was different than the racism he had seen down south.
It has certain patterns of racial separation, but they were not expressed in brutal forms. It was a more subtle kind of racism, which I think is still around.
English says the way the black neighborhood was pushed out of the city gets straight at the heart of the type of racism that was here.
Urban renewal authorities were set up to make sure that the law was attended to in terms of what would be a fair price and what would be resources available for that, for them to make a relocation out of the district that were being destroyed.
He sums up what he saw like this. The city of Charleston told the black community essentially to wait and see how the redevelopment could help them by bringing more economic prosperity to the city. More than four decades later, he feels many African Americans still struggle and are still waiting for these developments to pay off for them.
Oh, absolutely. Long time. And still waiting. Yeah. Still waiting. I think that has aggravated their irritation with waiting.
But Danny Jones, who served as Charleston mayor from 2003 to 2019, points out many of the homes in this neighborhood were in disrepair, largely because the landlords didn't maintain them. Rezoning this area for business was necessary, he says, to save the city from economic deterioration.
I don't know how I would have done it any other way. I mean, if we didn't take the interstate through the city, we'd have had to run it way around the city, and Charleston really would have died a quick death. So I don't know where else you'd have put it. But that doesn't dispel the feeling. Sometimes we don't live in a perfect world, and I don't feel good about their bad feelings. And I know a lot of those folks, and a lot of them are still around. And they're upset.
One of those still upset is Myrna Geiger. You may remember we heard from her at the beginning of this story. She says she doesn't think the plan to redevelop her neighborhood provided enough economic benefits to offset the loss that the African-American community experienced.
And, you know, and I never could understand why. I know the land was very valuable, and I do know that people who owned their land, the blocks who owned the land, churches who owned their land, did not get their money's worth for the land when it was purchased. I guess in some instances, I was not always for this urban renewal plan, and I know we have to move forward. But I think to displace all these people at this time and not help or find them places to go, I don't think that was right. We weren't out over in somebody else's area, wrecking havoc, stayed right down there in the triangle with our own people, did our own thing. So, you know, I never could figure out why they wanted to disperse the blacks like that. I couldn't understand that because I didn't see us bothering anybody.
On the day when I went with Mrs. Geiger to the Metropolitan Baptist Church, her preacher, Latari Thompson, told the story about David and Goliath.
Yeah. Here's what I need you to understand in this room on this day. When you stand for righteousness, the Lord himself will fight for you. When you stand in righteousness, the Lord will defend you. When you stand in righteousness, the Lord will dispatch angels to war on your behalf. When you stand in righteousness, the Lord will send ambushments and derisions upon your enemies to confuse them and bewilder them. Yeah, I'm talking to a few folk in this room. Because when you know that the Lord...
As I sat listening to the sermon, I, of course, couldn't help but think of how it may be related to this whole story about the residents who used to live in the Triangle District, folks like Mrs. Geiger, many of whom tried to stand up against bigger powers, similar to David facing Goliath. But in this case, the giant prevailed. The interstates were built. Or maybe these residents did attain a bit of victory because they're still remembering their community and they're still talking about these memories. They haven't lost everything. These interviews were all conducted before coronavirus came to West Virginia. Just a week after I attended the church service with Mrs. Geiger, the governor issued a stay-at-home order for the state. And like many churches across the country, the Metropolitan Baptist Church stopped holding in-person services. I checked back in with Mrs. Geiger to ask how she was holding up. It occurred to me that her church is kind of like an anchor back to her memories of childhood and of her neighborhood that was destroyed. Without that church, she has even less. Myrna says her church is now holding services online, and she's been able to stream it each Sunday. It's not the same, but it's something to keep her rooted back to the Triangle neighborhood, kind of.
Likewise, just a few days before the first case of COVID-19 entered the state, I attended a meeting of former community residents hosted by Reverend Ron English. Every now and then, they gather inside the Shiloh Baptist Church on Washington Street, also in the area that used to be in the Triangle District. They come to reminisce about their old neighborhood. If you ask Reverend English, emotions linger over the loss of the Triangle because former residents never got the chance to grieve for the community as a community. So these informal get-togethers help residents heal.
When that devastation came, and that was that experience of loss, it was never mourned in terms of a collective mourning. And so what I heard the first time that we met was both a sense of the loss that they felt, but also how the conversations suggested that they had not mourned, and this was a celebration of what had not been the reaction at the time, collectively.
There were only a few people gathered that day in the downstairs activity room of the church. Two grainy images hung on the cinder block walls, showing the original church that was torn down to make way for the interstate. Beside that was another photo of this church building that replaced it. I met Robert Burton. He has such strong memories of his home in the Triangle, he was recently moved to write a poem. Here's a little bit of it.
I was awakened to laughter, had voices, and even moans. This was the movement and sounds of people that I had once known. I watched the array of colors of cloths. It was like being in a field of beautiful butterflies and moths. Now the music of Mr. Lacey's speakers filled the air. He was the radio TV repairman shop that was placed there. Black people danced and pranced up and down Court Street, shimmering and shaking with each other.
Robert Burton's poem ends with a mixture of love and loss for the Triangle that nearly everyone involved attempts to express.
There is tears in my eyes, a pain in my heart, as I remember a wonderful place where my childhood and my adult basically were to start. And part. The queen of the city, yes it was. I call it the Triangle District. And this poem was written with love.
By 1975, the Triangle District was gone. Some people say Charleston has never really reckoned with all this history.
Recently, city officials did give Court Street an honorary title of Martin Luther King Jr. Way. This was the road that ran right through the heart of the Triangle District.
The process of uniting for that compromise gathered people who hadn't had a chance to reflect on the Triangle together since the area was torn down.
Still, faith leaders and community organizers said they would like the city to do more to help African American families who are still left in the city. Many of them live now in a part of the city known as the West Side, about a mile across the Elk River from where the Triangle neighborhood once stood. We'll hear more about that neighborhood in the second half of this episode. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas.
And I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston, West Virginia.
You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Suzanne Higgins, guest host this week. We want to thank those who helped us collect our Triangle interviews: Nathan Togger, Alex and Eric Abrahams, Reverend Paul Dunn, and Reverend Matthew Watts, Trey Kay, who hosts the Us and Them podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Also, our thanks to Anna Sale, whose research into the protests against the Urban Renewal Project in the Triangle was the subject of her bachelor's thesis, which helped us in putting our story together. After the break, we'll hear from those who live in another neighborhood in Charleston, the West Side. Like the Triangle neighborhood, it too has a high percentage of Black residents. Some who live there say it's been neglected by city officials and that racism continues to divide the city.
You talk to me and the people that I've been working with for 40 years, and they would say it's a hard place if you're Black, and it's doubly hard if you're poor.
We'll hear from people who live in Charleston's West Side who are pushing against negative stereotypes and making improvements in their community. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Suzanne Higgins. We'll be right back.
Nobody turn me around.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're looking at the tensions over urban renewal and development that played out in the Appalachian city of Charleston, West Virginia. Of course, stories like these occurred in communities across the country, and in some ways are still occurring today. Before the break, residents of the former Triangle neighborhood recalled what happened to them in the 1960s and 70s. Next, we hear from people who live in Charleston today, several of whom say the Black community has never recovered from the loss of the Triangle neighborhood. The West Side is a neighborhood that struggles with a reputation of high crime rates and many abandoned homes. The city council recently relaxed its zoning rules for this neighborhood, a move that could lead to the construction of affordable housing here. But some opponents of the zoning change argue the city doesn't have a master plan for how it intends to develop the West Side neighborhood. And some residents even wonder if history could repeat itself, that this part of town could see changes that would push out Black and low-income residents, like what happened in the Triangle. Robert Burton is a West Side resident who disagrees with the zoning vote. We heard from him earlier, reading his poem about the Triangle. Burton says he thinks the city council should not have voted while people are at home sheltering in place because of the coronavirus. He says it mirrors the way the Black community wasn't consulted properly during the redevelopment of the Triangle District. Another resident who's concerned about how city officials are treating the West Side neighborhood is Reverend Matthew Watts, a Baptist preacher who serves a church in this neighborhood.
You talk to some people, it's a wonderful place. Everybody gets along well, right? Great community. You talk to me and the people that I've been working with for 40 years, and they would say it's a hard place if you're Black, and it's doubly hard if you're poor, and it's triply hard if you're Black. You think with your own mind, you have your own ideas, if you're willing to stand up and speak truth to power.
Reverend Watts describes his community as a place with some tough realities. The drug epidemic has hit especially hard here. Many families also struggle economically. Many of the children who attend elementary school live in broken homes and have experienced trauma. Out of the Block's podcast producer, Aaron Henkin, of WYPR in Baltimore, teamed up with West Virginia's state folklorist, Emily Hilliard, to record a series of interviews with residents. Hilliard is the founding director of the West Virginia Folklife Program at the West Virginia Humanities Council. She and Aaron produced a series of audio vignettes as residents described in their own words the challenges and triumphs they see in their community. First, we traveled to Mary C. Snow Elementary School, which provides mental health care and a therapy dog to help neighborhood children.
Hey, Axel, come here. Come.
Good boy.
High five.
Such a good boy.
Lay down. My name's Walter Tucker. I'm one of the musical directors here at Mary C. Snow Westside Elementary, and I'm Axel's handler, which is our therapy dog. He travels to all the classrooms with our counselor, so he gets the opportunity to interact with all the children here in the school. Yep, he's sniffing the mic right now. One student of ours that was coming in the morning, autistic student, he would cry every morning. And when he would come down the hallway and he would see Axel, he would stop crying. So every morning that student would come down, just spend like 5 minutes with him, and then he would stop crying and he'd be ready to go back to class. Good boy. Yep. Oh, there we go. Tired pup. I call him my little bear.
It is very busy between medicines and accidents and boo-boos and illnesses, and it's lots of job security. I'm Janet Alio, and I'm the school nurse and the healthcare coordinator. And on an average, I see between 30 and 40 kids a day. They may appear in the morning with a bruise or a bump or something, but there's always a history. There's a history behind the illness. There's a history behind the injury. So one of my goals is to be able to meet that need, not just identify it. Some of our children leave here at night and they don't even know where they're going to go to bed at that night. I had a student that was not a frequent flyer in the clinic. I do get frequent flyers that just like to come by. Sometimes it's just for a sweet hug, which I love, and other times it's to try to escape out of class. But this boy, he was about the fifth grade, came in, and he'd been so sleepy he couldn't stay awake, so he came down, and I did an assessment and checked him out, and I always say, did you get to bed on time last night? And he said, no, I was up late. I couldn't sleep. I said, well, why couldn't you sleep? He said, because of the gunshots outside my bedroom window. We have the school-based health center. We have a dental clinic. We have on-site mental health so that our children can have therapy here at school. We were finding that some of the children who needed therapy, their parents didn't have transportation to get them to therapy, or they would have to miss the entire day. So now a child can miss 30, 40 minutes of the school day, get their therapy. The same with going to the doctor. They can only miss a half an hour instead of a whole day. Before a child can learn, they have to be emotionally in a good place.
We're listening to a series of interviews with people who live and work in the west side of Charleston, West Virginia. They originally aired in a podcast called Out of the Blocks from WYPR. Neighborhood residents were asked to describe in their own words how they envision their community, like Reverend Matthew Watts, who we heard from earlier. Here's more of his story.
Well, I'm a native West Virginian, born and raised in the southern West Virginia coal fields in Fayette County, but I've lived here for 40 years, actually. My name is Matthew J. Watts. I'm the senior pastor and teacher of the Grace Bible Church of Charleston. And so when I became the senior pastor of the Grace Bible Church, I persuaded the church for us to move to the west side of Charleston, that the need there was great because of the challenges and the fact that it has the highest concentration of African Americans that live anywhere in the state of West Virginia was another pull for me to come to the West Side. I think what it's up against is a history that is couched in slavery, discrimination, marginalization, exclusion, and exploitation. The West Side was established as 5 slave plantations, places like Hunt Avenue, where the Hunt were slave owners. Coyer Street, a major street downtown, is also part of the West Side, slave owners. Summer Street, slave owners. The Patrick Street Bridge, slave owners, right? And that history basically was totally ignored. No one talked about it. And so it helped us to begin to educate the community how to counter, to offset 155 years of history that's laid down like shellac in layers, right? I walk a lot. That's why I got this, you know, walking suit on, right? I had this heart attack last year. Now I'm serious about my health and so forth. I see the pain of poor people. I see the pain of black people in particular. My wife and I moved in on the street at the time. It was the toughest street on the west side of Charleston about 6 years ago. I feel led to do that because I feel like I've got to feel the pain of the people. Their pain got to become my pain. Their problem got to become my problem, because if it is, I'll be more creative, more disciplined, more determined, and more resolved. I'm more courageous to try to do something about it. And so by the time I get to the pulpit on Sunday morning, I know that some of my people experience that pain as well. And so I look out on my congregation and I see them out there. And I know the people whose son is in prison. I know the grandmother lived across the street who's raising her granddaughters because her daughter has her problem. And what I see in my congregation, I see incredible resiliency. We have kids in our church that have been dealt a tough hand. You know, some of them, fathers in prison. Some of their fathers are dead. Some of my kids don't know who their fathers are. But they're going to school every day. And they're trying, right? And they're solid citizens in school. And they have every reason to say, I'm mad at the world. right, and be wreaking havoc within the school system. And we just got the report cards, and we're just so excited because they all did well. Their resolve also motivates me in terms of the human spirit. So you keep trying to do the best you can every day.
Again, that was Reverend Matthew Watts. One of the great things about going into a community and spending time talking with residents, like Reverend Watts, is you learn about people and places that you'd totally miss if you just picked up a tourist brochure or if you simply drove through the main streets of the city. That's what's so special, I think, about the series we're listening to. The producers went along with West Virginia State folklorist Emily Hilliard to really listen at length to just some of the people who make this neighborhood unique. Let's meet one more resident today of Charleston's West Side. Mr. Tom Tolliver is an energetic elderly gentleman with an inspiring vision for helping people with gardening.
So you have a photo album here want to share?
Yeah, the reason I want to show it to you because it's very important. There they are. Okay, here they are, the young kids that I took over. Here they are in there, they're beginning to grow up now. And now, here are the children now, they're grown. If you know what these kids came through, can you imagine a mother and father in prison and nobody? So I feel so blessed that I was able to help them. They're miracle children. My name is Thomas Tolliver. Well, actually, I've been going into prisons about 30 years. Other people may go to preach, I go to mentor. And the very first case I had, this lady, this family that I ran into, she says, my husband's in federal prison. I said, husband? And this young lady ended up with four children. So I began to work with this one family. One day, my wife and I had them over to dinner, the kids are prisoners, about four of them. And casually, she asked one of the children, do you know where these green beans came from? They said, Kroger's. And everybody laughed but us. I found that was very pitiful to know that we have kids that didn't know how food was produced that they ate. So the very next day, I went out and began to look for land that I could start a garden. So Charleston Urban Renewal let me have this property here. See these here? They're called container beds. Right now, what's growing in here is winter greens. What grew in here was tomatoes, corn, and green beans, squash, and turnips. We've already harvested this. It was a progression from men and children of prisoners to an urban farm. Also have an orchard there. It's a peach and apple orchard in there. As a boy, about 13 or 14, I plowed with a horse. I grew up growing gardening so we would have adequate food to eat. So that is really the beginning of my knowledge of growing food for my, you know, for the way I came up. I'm so thankful the way I turned out that in my family, now what I try to do, what I've done with my family, can I do this with the neighbor, with the homeless and street people? Can I do that with them? This is inclusive. Anybody who wants to come in and join with me, they can. And like I said, it's farming. It can be fun and then to watch stuff grow and then eat it. It amazes a lot of children too, you know, even adults. It was so funny though. I've had funny experiences. I had a bunch of kids and I had a bunch of tomato plants and we was planting them. I mean, I was showing them sort of made like regimentary. I'd drill a hole, another person would come by and drop the tomato in, another would tamp it. You know, I had a little, it was going good. But I looked back around, there was a kid pulling them up. I said, son, please don't touch another one of those tomatoes. And well, the other kids wanted to kill him, but I couldn't figure out why he was doing that, you know. And I said, there are some mental things, but, you know, if you get kids interested, they love to do this. If you notice that a tomato rottens from the inside out, so when you deal with people, you better deal with the inside so you can develop the outside. So if that's the case with a tomato, then we're seeing people rotten from the inside. So let's deal with that. And in a progression of time, maybe they'll develop better.
Mr. Tolliver says that since the spread of COVID-19 has made community work more dangerous, he hasn't been interacting quite as much with his neighbors these past few weeks. But as we can imagine, he's been spending a lot of time working in the community garden he's built in his neighborhood. Like many others across the country, he's hoping the pandemic will inspire others to take a renewed interest in finding healing through growing their own food. As mentioned earlier, Charleston's West Side has a reputation for being a tough place to live, but there are businesses and people here that truly make this neighborhood a special community. The series of stories we've been listening to includes many voices, but we don't have time to listen to all of them in today's show, so we really hope that you'll listen to the full series. There's a famous barbecue restaurant, a clarinetist who plays in the West Virginia Symphony, a man who's been selling movie theater tickets since 1962, and much more. Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick produced this series with the help of Emily Hilliard. We've posted a link to the full podcast from Out of the Blocks on our website, wvpublic.org. In today's show, we heard from a number of people about the struggles two communities have faced over a span of about 50 years. Some say the troubles Charleston's West Side residents face are rooted in racial discrimination by city planners. And some point to the story of the Triangle neighborhood as one example of how the city's past mirrors patterns of neglect they believe the city continues to show in the West Side. We didn't set out today to resolve questions over disparities, either past or present, and we aren't taking sides on whether Charleston is currently neglecting its African American citizens. But we did want to highlight some of the voices of residents who say they've been shut out of the conversation about their city for years. Because racial tensions continue to exist in Charleston, as they do across Appalachia and the nation. During this quiet quarantine at home, as so many of our favorite neighborhood businesses, shops, and gathering spots are closed for the time being, maybe we'll take some time to reflect on the way we treat our neighbors. Will we return to normal? Or will we learn from our experience in isolation and find ways to strengthen our communities? Perhaps we'll ask ourselves, who are we including and who are we shutting out of the conversation about how to bring economic prosperity and well-being to everyone? Till next time, thanks for joining us as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had scripting assistance this week from Jesse Wright at 100 Days in Appalachia, which is published by the West Virginia University Reed College of Media Innovation Center. We also had help from the West Virginia Humanities Council and WYPR in Baltimore and their podcast, Out of the Blocks. Our theme music is by Matt Jackfort. Other music this week was provided by the Freedom Singers, Rhiannon Giddens as heard on Mountain Stage, Marissa Anderson, and Dinosaur Burps. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Glynis Ford. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy helped produce our show this week. I'm Suzanne Higgins, and I had the pleasure of editing today's program. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. And visit wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.